Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
That's Frankenstein.
Is anybody got a dime?
Der Schwartz.
I am Frau Blücher.
I'm not going into the toilet. I'm going into show business.
Zipper Nick.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Bialystok in blue. Bialystok in blue.
Now listen to me very carefully. Don't put the candle back.
Well, that suitably Brooksian audio logo means it's time for the third and final installment of our Mel Brooks docuseries. Actually, it's more of a docuseriesette. Today's installment is about Mel's Western satire, Blazing Saddles. Milwaukee biographer and film historian Patrick McGilligan joins us. He's the author of the definitive Mel Brooks biography, Funny Man, Mel Brooks. The passage about Blazing Saddles unveils a lot of the sliding doors behind the iconic comedy. Patrick joins us to talk about how the movie has aged, how it holds up, and how the idea actually came from a Madisonian.
The Madison connection to Blazing Saddles is very important because yes. Andrew Bergman, who was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, conceived the idea while he was in Madison of writing a black Western called Tex X, as in Malcolm X, and it would start, he had this idea of, you know, this black sheriff coming to town on a stallion, coming down Main Street, a frontier town, and it's a racist, it's a white racist frontier town, mm-hmm. and it was going to be a comedy.
By the power vested in me, by the Honorable William J. LaPetitMaine, I hereby assume the duties of the office of sheriff in and for the township of Rock Ridge.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, let us not allow anger to rule the day. As your spiritual leader, I implore you to pay heed to this good book and what it has to say. Son, you're on your own.
And he went back to New York, and while he was a publicist, he wrote this novel. And the novel was good enough that it was optioned, and Bergman wrote a draft of a script, and it was really, at one point, scheduled to be filmed. And then Warner Brothers dropped it, at which point Mel Brooks enters the story. Now, he's kind of down on his luck from his own point of view, because neither the producers nor 12 Chairs have made him rich. And he runs into his agent, and his agent takes him out to lunch and then into his office and says, you know, the script came across, and it's really good, but it really needs your crazy touch. And would you? And Mel always says when this kind of conversation takes place, well, I only do my own stuff, you know. But of course, as the book shows, he's doing other people's stuff over and over again throughout yes. his career. And that's yeah. one of the ways in which he's been very fortunate and also very shrewd by picking up on other people's ideas. So he reads the script. He calls Andrew Bergman. He says, I love it. Would you work on this with me? Which is his first shrewd move. And Andrew Bergman says, absolutely. You know, he adores Mel. He knows about him all the way back to your show of shows. And so Mel flies off to Acapulco, where he's doing a television special. He meets a guy there named Norman Steinberg, who he had met much earlier in time. And he said, I have this script back in New York. Do you want to like work on it with me? And Norman said, well, I have this writing partner and he's a dentist. And, you know, when he's not, you know, working as a writer and, you know, Mel raises an eyebrow, go, oh, a dentist and a lawyer. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. So, you know, and he gets these three guys together in a room, which by the way, enormously talented three guys. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, you know, I see four Jews here and I think we need a black person because of all the scenes with this, you know, black sheriff.
And the rest is history. Impressed? Always like to keep my audience riveted.
And so they kick around a few names, and Norman claims that, you know, he thought of Richard Pryor, and Mel claims that he thought of Richard Pryor. You know, Mel talks to Richard, and Mel says, we can't use the N-word, can we? And Richard said, you can't, but the bad guys could. And the N-word was sprinkled throughout the novel, you know, Andrew Bergman's original script, and that was part of the joke of the story, as it is an important part of the joke of the film. So they bring Richard Pryor in, and he doesn't last too long because he's drinking and doing coke. Mm. But he lasts long enough to really, really put his imprint on the film. And I think to make that part of the film, the racial commentary and the black character, Black Bart is his name, very, very important, partly because it was always thought that Richard Pryor would probably play it.
Why didn't Richard Pryor end up playing the part of Black Bart?
Well, it's a bit murky as to why Richard Pryor did not end up playing Black Bart. I think there was a sincere wish that he would. And Mel always said that Warner Brothers vetoed him because they were afraid that he wouldn't show up and that they wanted a bigger box office name. Because as I said, Pryor wasn't really established as a film personality at this point in time. It turned out to be serendipity because Anne Bancroft, who was very important to the early casting of Mel's first films, she reminded him of Cleavon Little, this actor who was not particularly well known. And I think Cleavon Little is just spectacular in the film. And he was cast, again, not at the 11th hour, but at the 10th hour, as a substitute for Richard Pryor. And that was serendipity, just as Gene Wilder was not going to be playing the Waco kid. Mel wanted an old Hollywood name in that part, and they looked at various people, including John Carradine and some other like old-time Western actor, and they finally got Gig Young, who's not really a Western actor, but he was an established name.
Yes.
They got him to play the part. He was a recovering alcoholic or an alcoholic, depending on your who you believe. And on the first day of filming, went into a kind of post-alcoholic fit and had to be rushed by ambulance to the hospital. And Mel ran to a phone booth back in those good old days when there were phone booths outside the soundstage and phoned Gene Wilder, who was getting ready to go overseas to film The Little Prince with another director in London, and said, please come out here and save me and be in this movie. And Gene Wilder, they did have a good friendship, got on a plane, got out, and over a weekend, picked out a horse, picked out a costume, and, that Monday morning, played that scene where he wakes up in the jail cell upside down and said, are we black?
Drunk and number two must be awake.
Are we awake?
We are not sure. Are we black?
Yes, we are.
Then we're awake. But we're very puzzled. I think I'd better straighten myself out.
Need any help?
Oh, all I can get.
It seems improbable, if not impossible, that Gig Young would be good at all in that part. And Gene Wilder being Richard Pryor's age, being a touch daffy, Richard Pryor, and playing off Cleavon Little's smoothness, was really, really just a brilliant, final stroke of casting. Completely accidental.
Yes, for sure. We can't really talk about Blazing Saddles without talking about the famous campfire scene.
How about some more beans, Mr. Taggart?
I'd say you've had enough.
Who came up with that idea?
Well, I can't pin it down, even though I talked to all the survivors in the room who are working on the script, and every one of them says they might have thought of it or Mel might have thought of it. It's the kind of thing they would have thought of because they described those sessions as very, very free, give and take, free-for-alls, with a lot of crazy ideas and everybody saying, oh, no, that's not funny, or, oh, that's really, really funny. And, the thing that made people laugh the most is what they decided to do. So somebody came up with it, but whoever came up with it, Mel said, I love it. And usually when Mel loves something later on, it becomes something that he thought of, in his reminiscences. And then, on the set, all the actors liked, including these, old-time actors like Slim Pickens, who recently converted to comedy in Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, but otherwise really wasn't known for comedy. And, they did this very elaborate you know, shooting of that scene on the set where Mel would say, now lift one side of your buttock, now lift the other side of your buttock. And he prided himself on, you know, he was going to put all the fart noises in post-production because he loved post-production. Mm-hmm. And he loved putting noises in yeah. post-production, including, you know, noises out of his own mouth. Yeah. And so he and all the sound people had great fun, you know, flapping their arms with making fart noises and making, and it's one of his specialties, rubber faces and crazy noises coming out of his mouth. And it really now seems passé. And yet, the way it's staged and how it happens is still very, very funny. It's not dated at all.
How did the audiences, the public, respond to Blazing Saddles and the idea of a black sheriff and the use of the frequent use of the N-word?
The N-word was used frequently in Richard Pryor's act. It was used in many, many other films being made at the time. It was used by black power militants. So when Andrew Bergman thought of it, it was pervasive in the culture, and it wasn't always used for comedy, but it was used for comedy in some circumstances. So this might be, you know, by the time Blazing Saddles is released, this might be the end of that cultural curve, meaning this might be the last time you could do it.
Yes.
And it certainly is done pervasively in the film. It certainly is done with Richard Pryor's help. Very, very intelligently, shrewdly, critically, interestingly, hilariously. And it wasn't commented on negatively in reviews at all. I mean, Mel gives interviews nowadays where he says, you know, we couldn't make that kind of film nowadays because it's politically incorrect. I'm not sure, because it's so well done, it got away with it, as it was being gotten away with in the culture at large when it was really well done. I mean, people really, really get the point. It's an anti-racist point, as Richard Pryor pointed out in his initial conversations with Mel, i.e. the bad guys can say it, but the good guys shouldn't say it. So it gives the film a level, a strange level of seriousness that it's really not very serious about, meaning it's not a filmmaking giving political messages. But that serious aspect of the film remains, you know, that Black Bart, even though he's a complete cartoon character and a fictional creation, so much so that we see at the end of the film that he's being played by an actor, that Black Bart is facing prejudice in the white frontier town where everybody is named Johnson, and there's one flavor of Howard and Johnson's ice cream yeah. because it's early in time. Yeah. And all these jokes about white frontier town that I consider to be pretty subversive, even though most people take them on the chin nowadays and don't necessarily see their subversiveness. To be honest, most people, like when I show the film to my class at Marquette, people laugh. But afterwards, I ask them, well, why is the Howard Johnson's joke funny? Well, they don't know.
No, of course not.
So I give them a whole list of questions. Who is Madeline Kahn burlesquing in the film? They don't know.
No.
Their guesses are kind of funny, but they have no idea. And it's kind of like what Woody Allen said about Mel Brooks when someone asked him if he liked Mel Brooks's comedy. He said, well, I don't like them all, but, you know, what I really like is he gets so much joy out of his comedy. You know, there's a joy in his comedy that Allen never got out of his own comedies. And they had been acquaintances and worked together on Sid Caesar television shows back in the late 1950s, so they knew each other. And I think that spirit, that sort of merry, subversive, you know, noisy spirit of Blazing Saddles lives on. It's very, very strong. And so people laugh often when they don't get the jokes, but I think they get the Black Bart joke.
Yeah, very well said. Patrick McGilligan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Patrick McGilligan is the author of Funny Man, Mel Brooks. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Jenna Friedman, Brian J. Cramp, and Patrick McGilligan. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter @wprbeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
Special thanks to producer Tyler Ditter.
Like I told you, once you establish yourself, they got to accept you.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
My mind is a raging torrent, flooded with rivulets of thought, cascading into a waterfall of creative alternatives.